Hello, is this thing on? Welcome to the latest edition of Big Mouth, the pop culture show for the modern obsessive, where we dig into music, film, TV, books, and all related matters with a firm but fair shovel. My name's Andrew Harrison, and this week we will be investigating Trainspotting 2, Okai, Wee, Raj, Catboy, Lassie. Is the sequel to the iconic Danny Boyle / Irvin Welsh movie from 1996 a worthy successor? We'll be cocking an ear too at the debut album by unconventional soul man Rag & Bone Man. Is he really the White Barry White? And inevitably, we'll be having a brief row about whether the next Doctor Who ought to be a woman or and or a Time Lord of colour. But first, let's meet our guests for the show. He is the Times' chief rock and pop critic and a prolific author whose books include Guitar Man and Song Man, where he attempts to learn the guitar and write songs from scratch with a little help from minor talents like Johnny Marr, Roger McGuinn, Keith Richards and Shirley Collins. He's also written The House is Full of Yogis, which is about being brought up by hippies. And he's kind of wasted on radio because he's the only rock journalist who can be bothered to dress up like a rock journalist with a quality Mark Bolan meets Sly Stone look. It is the delightful Will Hutchinson. Hello, Will.
Hello, thank you very much. That was a very nice introduction.
Welcome to the Big Mouth Dungeon. What have you been up to with the Times?
Last night I went to see Donny Osmond.
Oh, really?
Wow.
And that was a shameless... I've never seen anything like it. I mean, outside of Las Vegas, which I've never been to, it was the most shameless pandering to what the audience want, which, as you can imagine, was all women in their 50s and 60s.
Yes.
It was, I mean, essentially, it was pornographic.
Sounds great, actually.
I mean, I'm booking my tickets.
You know, when you come up through the era of contempt for the audience and that kind of thing.
It's quite
pandering.
The opposite.
Yeah, it sounds quite rock and roll, actually, you know.
Well, I'd say half the time he was singing.
Yes.
But the other half of the time he was in the audience having his photograph taken. He was doing competitions during the actual event where you could win to have your photograph taken in about 5 minutes' time.
This is great.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
Did he do Crazy Horses?
Yes, he did Crazy Horses. He did, you know, he did Puppy Love. I mean, he did everything you'd expect. And what was quite...
Plus porn.
Well, I mean, it kind of was. I mean, the big joke was, you know, he started going on about Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and saying, well, my agent said I had to do this because it would be very exposing. And then he took out the loincloth that he wore and everyone went, woo!
Well, when he did Crazy Horses, did the entire audience go, woo!
Yeah, he did. He had a little conversation about that. It was all to do with the keyboard that was used.
Ah.
I thought it was a guitar. It wasn't. It was a keyboard. So there was a little
bit of
that.
That's a top pop fact.
It's a top pop fact. At which point, the entire audience started staring at their phones because they were not interested in that fact.
Brilliant.
It's like, oh, yes, that's fantastic. Yeah, what did you say? The Korg 106?
Something for the one muso in the audience.
That's good. It's covering all the bases. Also with us today, you heard her just there, returning to Big Mouth. She is a writer and broadcaster for Radio 4 and The Observer, where she does the radio column. She's a graduate of Smash Hits magazine and Good Old Select, where she did the classic Happy Mondays in Barbados story, where they sold all the studio furniture for crack and Bez ended up with a giant metal structure holding his arm together. Her latest book, Out of Time, is a funny and moderately terrifying meditation on the nature of middle age in an era of permanent youth. It is famous Miranda Bonnie Sawyer. Hello, Miranda. How are you?
Hello. Can I just say I never went to Barbados? You never sent me to Barbados. That's the main thing I'd like to say about that piece. It was all done by interviews.
You did the story and you created the illusion that you'd gone to Barbados.
I never went.
We're not made of money. Even in the 90s when we were kind of slightly made of money, we made of that much money. Anyway, you wouldn't have wanted to go to Barbados with the Happy Mondays. You might have died.
That's very true. I would have died.
You were a professional, but not that much of a professional, yeah. I don't think.
Come on, Bonnie, give us a hand with this sofa while we put it on the back of a flatbed.
Yeah, it would have been terrifying. They were driving around the entire... They kept crashing cars, didn't they? They had like kind of golf cart cars and they're driving around the island, crash car, get another one.
Yes.
Score some crack, then do the same thing again. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have lasted.
It's like Centre Parks.
I'd have got overexcited.
Cheating old Centre Parks. Anyway, you also heard his voice there. Let's not forget the most important person in the room, the one who ensures appropriate levels of sonic amazingness. It is our producer, the one man, Clive Langer and Alan Winstanley of podcasts, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm good.
You had to think for a minute then, didn't you? Am I good? How's your week been?
It's been good.
What's been happening?
Lots of reading. For another podcast I do, I've been reading a lot of Alan Garner.
Stone
of Risen Gamma and Moon of Gomorrah. That's about the one that I haven't read.
Oh, right.
But I'm reading at the moment a quite amazing book, which is the third one in the Weird Stone of Risen Gamma trilogy.
Fact. Can I give you a
fact?
Yeah,
please.
Which is quite a devastating fact, which is, okay, so I'm for various reasons, I was in the car with somebody who was friendly with Alan Garner's son, And I grew up in Wilmslow, which is mentioned in the, you know, it's the first line of Weird Son of Brisingham, and Alderley Edge, which is all about where it's all based. Yeah. And there is a fountain there, and it's and carved into the rock. It says a face, and it says, "Drink of this and take thy fill, for the water falls by the wizard's will." Ancient, as far as we know. Alan Garner put it on there.
Oh, really? Wow.
He carved it. Brilliant. And he told me, and a little part of my heart broke.
Anyway, never mind. Let's get on with the stuff. Let's get started. As I mentioned, Trainspotting T2, with its rather annoying subtitle that sounds like HS2 High Speed Rail. It's 20 and a bit years since the huge impact of Danny Boyle's adaptation of the first Irvine Welsh novel into Trainspotting 1, as I suppose we must now call it. Now that same cast of ex and current junkies, robbers and general headbangers reassemble in Edinburgh. Has the world changed, or have they changed, and is there more to T2 than nostalgia? Before we return to the world of Renton, Sick Boy, Spud and Begbie, let's have a listen to the trailer from Trainspotting 2.
Hello, Mark. So what you been up to? For 20 years.
Choose life. Choose Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and hope that someone, somewhere cares.
Missed you, mate.
I missed you too, Spud.
Choose looking up old flames, wishing you'd done it all differently.
Do you still take heroin?
No.
And choose watching history repeat itself.
Hello, Franco.
Simon.
I'm home.
Choose your future.
Call the police.
What shall I say?
Just tell them we're dead.
Choose reality TV, slut shaming, revenge porn. Yeah. Choose a 0-hour contract, a 2-hour journey to work, and choose the same for your kids, only worse. And smother the pain with an unknown dose of an unknown drug made in somebody's kitchen. And then take a deep breath. An addict. So be addicted. Just be addicted to something else. Choose the ones you love. Choose your future. Choose life.
So Max says from Trainspotting 2 there, and if you've seen it, we're going to do a little spoiler-filled mini-cast after this show, so you can listen to that separately and find out all about the plot details, which obviously you already know. If you haven't, don't worry, we'll keep all major spoilers out of this bit, and we'll try our best anyway. So, with that in mind, Miranda Sawyer, quickly, sum up what's happening in Trainspotting 2.
What's happening in Trainspotting 2 is Renton has come back. That's the main plot point. So at the end of Trainspotting 1, he leaves with all the money, although he, well, it's not that much money, it's 16 grand that they did from a drug deal.
Yes.
And he leaves 4 grand for Spud, but he rips off Sick Boy and Begbie, and off he goes, and they never see him again. And it's now 20 years later, and he comes back. And the various cast, which is kind of reduced really to Begbie, Sick Boy, and Spud, are in various states, we can say. And I don't want... Should I reveal where they are? Is that allowed?
Well, they're in Edinburgh.
They're in Edinburgh, in various states, various kind of states. None of the states are that brilliant. Mm. And actually, it's revealed that Renton, who seems like he's on top of everything, isn't in such a brilliant state, really. Mm. And so then they kind of come together again after 20 years, and what that means to their past relationships and how that kind of explodes is what happens. If you've read Irvine Welsh stories, there are some of those stories within this, in the same way that in Trainspotting 1, they're kind of woven in, but it doesn't work. It's not like Porno, which was written with those characters 10 years later. It's not exactly like that, but there are bits that you would recognise if you've read the books.
And what did you enjoy it? What did you make of it as a film?
I did enjoy it. I didn't... it's the problem with trailers, isn't it? And I mean, hearing that trailer makes me kind of want to weep because it's so nostalgic. And there's elements of it that the film itself touches all the time on the first film and on nostalgia all the way through. And so you have a reaction to it. I think I really, really enjoyed seeing particularly Renton and Sick Boy together, just slobbing about. And that was, there's something about, they seem like your friends. I don't know why. You seem to know them. And I really, really enjoyed that. I think the plot goes completely haywire. And I have to say, as a femo, that it is incredibly irritating to have 4 middle-aged men return to this plot and then 2 middle-aged women who are actually really important to the first time round, which is Spud's girlfriend, now wife, and Kelly MacDonald's character, who just come in and out like that.
Well,
like,
they've been written out.
Hang on a minute. Yeah. What happens? But hang on a minute. Let me finish my point, speaking
before
as
I
a
mansplain
femo.
It at you.
Yeah, but exactly, before you mansplain it. I understand that everybody involved in that picture Irvin, Danny, Ewan, all of them, they are feminists. But it is really noticeable for somebody who was incredibly involved in the first one, felt very involved in the second one, that the women are just put back and replaced by a young, beautiful prostitute.
Yeah, fair point. But isn't the film is about... Matt's telling me, don't shout down the microphone. The film is about male loserdom, isn't it? And that's why... And those women are not losers.
No, but they are there. Or they are also appendages.
Well,
one's a uterus plot point,
yeah.
Without which Spud wouldn't feel so bad, and the other one is a fantastic high-powered lawyer, it would be really good to figure out how she got to that position.
She's a really interesting character, and I found a bit frustrating. And having said that, I really enjoyed the film, but it's just a bit irritating as somebody who engaged very strongly in that kind of culture to suddenly find yourself cut out.
Will, what did you think of Trainspotting 2?
First of all, I agree with Miranda. I thought that the characters were the female characters are really interesting, and they should have been developed more. But the thing that I felt, and this is a bit more of a shallow point, is that I actually really liked the material of the story. I liked the idea of middle age and trying to deal with middle age and what it means. And you know, the original film was actually a film about junkies, but it's remembered as a great Britpop caper.
Yes.
Mm. Actually, it was a very depressing movie about junkies. Mm. But it somehow in history has repainted it as Oasis, Blur, everything was great. Trainspotting was great, you know. Yeah. It was showing a kind of quite nasty side of life. What I felt, my great frustration with Trainspotting 2, is that Trainspotting 1 was made by fairly young people, and we were all young when we saw it, and all of the very modernistic ways of filming felt like they were real. Now, this time, there are very modernistic, or if that's even a word, but, you know, kind of flashy ways of filming and lots of techniques, and I didn't think it was convincing. It reminded me of when the Rolling Stones tried to keep up with new technology in the 1980s and the music went wrong.
Well, I mean, to an extent, to me, the surprising thing was that reprising a lot of the techniques, Anthony Dodd-Mantle, director of photography, I think it's the same one. They did the Judge Dredd movie. And I think, to me, it was, you know, using those old techniques was part of the film being about nostalgia. Because the entire cast is trapped in the past. And you see them not just kind of dealing with the long, long hangover of their hedonistic 90s, or it was the 80s originally. It was set in the 80s. The hedonistic youth. And, you know, the music echoes that, and everything that used to sound exciting and energetic now feels kind of sad. And all those amazing images that were, the idea that an explosive, ultra-colourful imagination could make, you know, crappy, you know, schemes in Edinburgh feel amazing, now feels desperately sad and desperately kind of retrograde. And I thought that was a conscious decision. I found it actually quite a moving picture for a lot of those reasons. You know, that what they're doing is looking back at the time when they were amazing, and they're not amazing anymore.
Speaking of somebody who never really got the first film, could accept what a big kind of cultural event it was, but I was living in Hackney, and if I wanted to see kind of hijinks on heroin, I could go down Well Street Market at any point of the day.
That's the Christmas panto at the Hackney Empire, isn't it? Hijinks on heroin.
But, but I came to this first one, I was just like, oh no, more grimness and more of the first half. And then by the second half, there are things that occur where you actually think it's not about, it is about kind of blokes trying to recapture that youth and that friendship that maybe wasn't ever really there, but it's the one thing that with rose-tinted glasses they're looking back on and thinking, at the start, thinking that they can kind of get it again. And that was actually, there was a period which was kind of in the film which was really, was quite moving. But I kept on just thinking all the way through it, is the mark of a good sequel that you don't have to have seen the first one for it to work as a film? And if so, does that work? Does Trainspotting 2 work without seeing and investing a huge amount in the first film? Who is this? Is this going to cut out everybody under 35?
I'm not being funny, but it's not for people who haven't seen the first film. Yeah. You have to see the first film to see the second film, and that's fine. I don't have any problem with that. Quite a lot of sequels are like that. That's okay.
I'd also say on that point, I think that film is very much made for middle-aged people, our generation.
And that's fine, because the first film was made for our generation. Even though it was about, obviously it was about junkies, but the feeling that you got when you watched the first film wasn't heroin. It was like a massive dose of speed. You came out and you kind of went... Yeah.
That was my frustration.
It's kind of it was a very speedy pop culture-y film, and they had quite a lot of the elements in this film I really liked when it went a bit kind of speedy and wonky. I quite liked them. I just think that some of the There's some really great set pieces, yeah. But I'm not sure that it quite hung together as the whole.
Just going back to what Andrew said about the kind of flashy elements reflecting the old film.
Yeah.
I felt they had tried to modernise it to for my taste too much, and also it's just the material's different. You know, yeah. This is a film. It is about middle age, and I felt that the story that they're trying to tell would have actually benefited from a much more sober approach. And that you would have got to the heart of... you would have got to the heart of it with just a little bit more reflection. You know, and so that was the frustration for me, because I thought this is really interesting material. It's fascinating to find out what's happened, you know, where lives go and what those values, even if they were values in the first place, what they mean 20 years later.
And also because the first film is about... friends, and it's about, you know, in your 20s, you, if you're lucky or if you want to, you move out of home and you make friends and you make your new life and that's it. But their friends all their friendship groups are from very, very long time ago, so it's like they grew up with each other.
Yeah.
And that's why I left home. I left home and went to London because it felt too restrictive. So that's what happens in the first film. They smash it. They can't do it. Renton can't do it anymore.
Well, Renton does it. The rest of them stay there.
So then he comes back. And that is a really, really interesting situation, I think. But it's just whether they quite handle it enough. There's bits that I felt quite moved with, but not...
Whatever happened to the Likely Lads kind of opening sequence with all the kind of kids playing football in burnt-out tenements and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it becomes more kiddie, doesn't it? I mean, it's interesting because I think when you hit middle age, there is an element where you actually, maybe because there are more children around in your middle age, that you return to the really young years. Whereas I think when you're in your 20s, you don't care. Who cares about what happened when you were three?
Yeah, it's the last thing you want to think about.
Yeah. Will, you're absolutely right. This is a film for middle-aged people. It's for people like us who saw it first time.
Which is fine.
But I wonder what... You know, if you're 22 and you're growing up in a much cleaner, suspicious of hedonism, and, you know, kids are tested for the
age of
nine.
Why would they go and see that film? That film is as much for them as anything else.
If they saw it, what would they think about the world it portrays? Because when you've got, you know, teenage drinking and drugging is on the way down. There's a great sort of...
Yeah, but that's a kind of ascribing a failure of imagination to people. I watch loads of shoot 'em up. You know, kind of films. I don't actually own a gun.
But the difference is, though, that a shoot-'em-up film is escapist entertainment. This is portraying a demographic slice of Britain that was in its 20s in the 90s.
But it's just a film about old people, isn't it? I mean, the same with most films are a film about old people. I mean, genuinely, most films are about kind of 30s, 40-somethings, aren't they? Yeah. I mean, that's just the nature of it. If you watch all the trailers that come in, there's quite a lot about, you know, middle-aged male angst.
Okay, well, I think that's probably enough Trainspotting for now. But you can go to our Audio Boom page, which is audioboom.com/Big Mouth, yeah?
Yeah.
And you can find the other one. You can find the little spoiler-laden Trainspotting one. Or, of course, if you subscribe via iTunes, you'll get it anyway for free. Okay, let's move on and let's have some tunes. Every week we ask our guests to bring in the track that they are obsessed with at the moment. Miranda Sawyer, what have you got for us?
Oh, I've brought some Warm Dusher, haven't I?
You have.
Okay.
I don't know anything about this.
Okay, okay. So I'm going to explain about Warm Dusher. I'm very glad they exist. So I live in Brixton, which is an area of South London, and it's known for very many things. But one of the things that's kind of slightly ignored about Brixton is it's always got a bit of a kind of what we used to call a dog and a string element. And there's always been kind of quite odd, grimy, grubby, horrible white boy music that has come out of Brixton. And some of it I am very fond of. And one of the bands I'm very fond of is Fat White Family. And they, God love them, cannot get on with each other. They're two very talented individuals in the centre of Fat White Family, one called Lewis and one called Saul, and they just can't get on with each other. So they occasionally split up and they go and do other things. And Lewis is off doing stuff with Moon Landings, which involves Maxine Peake. And Saul at the moment is doing stuff with Warm Dusher. And they make kind of slightly Fall-like, odd music. And there's going to be an album coming out, and it's made with a man called Dan Carey, who lives in Streatham, and he is a producer. He's produced lots of people, you know, including Kylie Minogue, weirdly. But he's produced lots of people. But one of the things he has is a record label called Speedy Wonderground. And if you want to have a record release on his label, you have to go in and you have to make a single in a day. That's it. And this is one of the singles that was made in a day.
Okay, and this is Warm Dusher and The Sweet Smell of Florida. That was fat white family offshoot of Warm Dusha and the Sweet Smell of Florida, as chosen unaccountably by Miranda Sawyer. Okay, right, from one end of the music industry to another. Heavy-duty soul person Rory Graham, a.k.a. Rag and Bone Man, is carrying the unfortunate baggage of winning the British Critics' Choice Award and coming second in the BBC Sound of 2017 poll. This usually means infinite commercial success and a deadly dreary artist. He's already had an iTunes number one, and if you were unfortunate enough to be stuck indoors on New Year's Eve, he did a fairly decent version of the Four Tops classic Reach Out, I'll Be There on Jules Holland's Hootenanny. So, will Rag & Bone Man's mix of blues and soul buck the trend of saleable tedium? Let's have a listen. From his debut album, Human, this is the title track and first single, Human.
Maybe I'm foolish, maybe I'm blind. Don't put the blame on me. I'm only human, I do what I can. I'm just a man, I do what I can. Don't put the blame on me. Don't put your blame on me.
What's a surging, urgent, real music emotion there? Rag & Bone Man with his debut single, Human. Will Hodgkinson, you're a real music guy. What did you make of this?
Oh, I don't know about that. He's no question he's got a very good voice. The song Human, I think, is going to be one of those songs which is going to be, you're going to hear it throughout the entire year.
Yeah.
It's going to be like last year there's that song 7 Years by Lucas Graham. It's going to be one of those ones. You know, yeah. It's just going to be everywhere.
It's not as bad as that.
Well, you know, I think it's in the same bracket. And for me, he's got this great voice. And, you know, the production, they know exactly what to do. They've got a bit of gospel in there, but yeah. Soul and all the rest of it. I just don't find it that interesting.
Yeah.
I don't, it's not bad.
Yeah.
It's very easy. There's nothing offensive about it. But I don't have any real, it has no real emotional pull on me. Or yeah. It doesn't really pique my curiosity.
Which is odd because it's a heavily emotional music, isn't it? It's all kind of excavating.
It's emoting music. Everything's in place.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying, I don't know the guy. And he might be, you know, it might be drawn deep from within his heart. But I couldn't feel, you know, what I felt was a very, very, very well stylized piece of pop soul.
Yeah.
But I didn't ever feel that I was being spoken to directly.
Yeah.
By another person, which is what I'm basically always, you know, looking for.
Yeah. Miranda Sawyer, I can't imagine a less Miranda Sawyer piece of music than this. What did you make of Rag & Bone Man?
There was a couple of tracks I quite like. There's one called, I've written them down, look, these are in my only notes. There you go, Arrow, which sounds like kind of soul.
Yeah, that is, that's the up one.
That's the upbeat soul one. And Be the Man, which has just got a couple of funny noises in that I quite like. I always like a bit of a funny noise in a track. I think that it's quite hard to be a big voiced singer these days, as it always has been, because actually we look for a big voiced singer, you know, we admire a big voiced singer, but in order to have a kind of pull on your heart, you have to have something different. And you know, that's why people end up as backing singers. And I certainly don't think that he should be a backing singer, because he wants to write and that's really brilliant. But it's very hard to hook people. And I think almost particularly now, because if you want Big Soul, then off you go to YouTube and you can find Big Soul, that's fine. Yeah. But the reason why I think it's not for us is because we've had our, you know, we know what Big Soul we like. And I think if you're younger, I mean, he's not very old, this fella, is he? Yeah.
No,
I hear his tracks on, Kiss and stuff. So actually, it's a bit like if you're in your late teens, early 20s, and you're not quite sure where you're going, and the Big Soul that we like seems very old, then you've got somebody that's maybe singing about love that you might understand. So I would imagine that's where it will go.
I mean, it does touch all those bases. You know, it's on Radio 2.
Yeah.
It's already been covered by a singer on one of the big Shiny Floor shows on Saturday night. I'm not sure which one, but, you know,
but
The Voice or whatever.
So he's a four quadrant artist.
So
he touches all the bases. And I think that's actually quite a
hard thing to do.
A, a hard thing to do, but B, a slightly cynical, not from his point of view, but the record company.
Yeah, I think that...
You know that in the record company, in every record company boardroom and A&R department for the last 6 years, it'll be, we need a man who's going to do an Adele.
Yeah.
And that is what he's going to do. You know, he's writing or he's performing and he's releasing songs that are emotive, impassioned, really well sung, quite well produced, broad enough to touch loads of different bases. And, you know that within the next 5 years he's going to do a Bond theme.
There's a bit, isn't there? There's also a little bit. It's not quite the same as some of those ones, though, because if you think about Sam Smith, is it Sam Smith?
Sam Smith,
that's what I mean. And he, like, there's something about him, because he came in slightly on the Disclosure tip, he came in on the kind of dance tip. There's something that seems a little different about him. I don't know, you know, I mean, he did go on to try and do a Bond theme, and, well, he, you know, whatever. And
He did one,
yeah, it wasn't very good. And the thing that seems slightly different about him is that kind of, you know, he's come quite straightforwardly in, hasn't he? It seems quite...
I just wanted to say, this guy's actually been around for quite a long time.
Yeah.
I remember being...
As a hip-hop artist.
Yeah, I remember being contacted about Rag & Bone Man 3 or 4 years ago. And he's been... And so I feel, I think, I agree with you, actually. I think that this guy is got, he's obviously got a deep love of music. I think his dad was a singer. I'm sure he loves a lot of blues and soul, and he's really just trying to get that across. Now an opportunity has arisen for him to do this. And, you know, with good reason, he's taking it.
Yeah.
But it's the way it's been, he's being positioned is going to be absolutely not challenging. Yeah. So yeah, it's going to be for younger people, but it's going to be but it's also harking back to a sound which is very reassuring. Now you've got to remember that if you go back to Otis Redding or whoever, that was cutting edge of its time.
Yeah.
Now I think what they're doing is they sort of it's getting all those elements, but with a slightly modern production. Actually, I don't think he's so much Adele. The person he really reminds me of is Emily Sondé, because she seemed very, like, you know, I remember when all the press came out about her, and she's a neuroscientist, she's from Scotland, she's got this unusual background, she's got a tattoo of Frida Kahlo, everything is weird. And then you listen to the music and think, this is the most conventional music ever. And it's a little bit like that. And again,
yeah, because he looks unconventional and he's come
he
from...
He does.
Well, that's the thing we haven't talked about. You were saying, you know, Sam Smith...
That's been used as a benefit.
A bit different because he comes from the downside. I mean, the thing with Rag & Bone Man is, like, he looks very, very unconventional for somebody in that pop context. You know, he's a big bloke with his beard and his tats and all the rest of it.
Yeah, and I like that. That's good, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's also used as again, you know, through no fault of his own, but that's all going to be used as a kind of marketing benefit because it's seen as a sign of authenticity as opposed to a shiny pop
the authenticity thing. This is what gets me, because I mean, you're absolutely right, you know, he has grown up loving this music and that's fine, and absolutely everybody in pop music is, you know, is derived what they love from another country and another people. That's what pop music is. What I don't understand is this absolute need for authenticity and everything, not just in the musical world that's created, but also in the emotional tone, because it is this kind of vaguely wounded, vaguely introspective. I've got to try and be a better man.
It's a look.
It's a look.
It's like, you know, another look is going out and doing disco. I'm going to do authenticity tonight.
But why do people want that look? Why do people want that? So slightly wounded, you know, introspective, more.
They want to get the girls.
But also, it gets to the stage where by the last track on the album, which is a cappella, essentially kind of slave spiritual about bury me with a bottle of rum at the crossroads. And I'm just going, man, you
screaming
know what? If I don't, I'm not a big kind of, you know, I don't hold any kind of authenticity torch, but you need to write somewhat about what you know.
Bury me on the North Circular.
Do you think that they're going to...
Sussex.
All of this stuff, there's nothing wrong with any of that. Yeah. But I just, for me, the music, I find it quite boring because it doesn't connect a really deep level.
There's no chink, is there? There's no broken bit.
It's not actually eccentric.
Yeah. Well, maybe it'll happen for him. Maybe he'll be big with this record, which seems like it will be, and then he can go away and make a... one that actually means something.
Do you think?
I don't know. I like to give people the benefit of the doubt.
I think he'll have a good career. It'll be fine for him. You know, I think it'll slot in easily, and I think Radio 2 will love it.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Yeah, fair enough. Let's move on with Will Hodgkinson's choice of music for his editor's recommendation. Will, what have you got for us to listen to?
This is Julie Byrne. I Live Now as a Singer. And I saw Julie Byrne a few years ago, and I was floored along with the other 15 middle-aged men rubbing their knees in the audience. And I just thought, yes, this is the woman for me.
Okay, well, on that bombshell, let's have a listen.
How's that gone for you?
Oh, it's great.
Fantastic. Let's have a listen then.
There ain't no you.
That was this Mortal Coil with Song to the Siren? No, it was Julie Byrne with I Live Now as a Singer, and the tears are rolling down Will Hodgins' cheeks from having that one on. Okay, let's move on to the undisputed massive story of the week, which is, of course, Peter Capaldi's decision to leave the starring role in Doctor Who, the world's greatest television programme. His last appearance is going to be in this year's Christmas special. So, as is traditional, there is now a heated debate about who the next Doctor ought to be, or specifically, should it be a woman or a person from an ethnic minority, or both? We will be discussing this matter with massive Whovians Will Hodgkinson and Miranda Sawyer in a minute. But first, to get you in the mood, here's a tune I've wanted to play on the show for ages. This is Smearin's Antisocial Club with What Else? The Doctor Who theme. Generation for the Nation with Version. You can beat that, Ron Grainer. That was Smearin's Antisocial Club with the Doctor Who theme. So, this is the new Pope for nerds, isn't it? The next Doctor. Is it interesting because the rest of the world is so miserable and depressing and we can retreat into the world of time and space? Miranda Sawyer, firstly, the argument about... I know you've got a son who loves Doctor Who.
Yeah, so I'm a late Whovian.
You like that, a late Whovian.
I was not interested in Doctor Who at all, as you well know, being proper Whovian. Yeah. And then suddenly my son became interested and I had to invite Andrew round. So please talk to him. I don't really know what to do.
Explain everything.
Yeah. And so then I have
stage an intervention.
Yeah, it was just like I just didn't really know what to do. And he watched them all. He's all the modern ones, not the old ones, I have to say.
We'll move on to that.
So he watched all the David Tennant and the Matt Smith and Christopher Eccleston. He has orders of, you know, the ones that he likes the best. He likes Peter Capaldi, but I think he likes Peter Capaldi because, and this is going to sound a massive clang, and I don't mean it to, but my husband, his dad, was in one of the Peter Capaldi episodes. So he is obviously, you know, that's very high on my son's, you know, wish list to have a dad in Doctor Who. And that was the Doctor Who that he was with. I think they need somebody younger. They do. Now, I don't really mind, weirdly, I don't mind if it's a man or a woman. I'd be quite interested to be not the usual posh boy, you know. I mean, that would be quite nice. Mm. I mean, he's not the usual posh boy. But I don't really care, actually, because Doctor Who has recently brought in very interesting female characters. I'm thinking of Missy, and I'm thinking of actually of all the companions have been very interesting, and River, and so I'm less worried about it than I perhaps would be.
The idea that people could object to there being a black or an Asian doctor is an absurd.
It's kind of irrelevant, I think. That's the colour is kind of irrelevant.
Yeah, it is irrelevant. I think that's kind of, you know, if there's a black doctor, that's absolutely, you know, we've seen there are black Time Lords. You know. But the question of whether there should be a woman doctor is more complicated, because the argument is that the doctor is one of the very, very few non-violent heroes for boys. He's the only hero who works things out with his mind and not with his suit of Tony Stark Iron Man armour.
But do you think that's changing a bit? Because I have a small boy who's interested in these things. He is very obsessed with things like The Flash and Supergirl and things like that. And there are elements of that are quite violent. But The Flash is not particularly violent. Mm-hmm. And he is welcoming to all sorts of different people. So the nature of superhero-dom for young people is changing and is much more PC and right on, or recognises that.
To me, it's like important that, says the guy with no kids, it's important that there should be something for boys. Like, kids like I was when I was a kid can't fight, can't play football. You've got somebody to look up to who's the guy with the sonic screwdriver.
You know what I think? I don't think it matters if it's a man or a woman. Mm-hmm. I think what's more important is that the doctor is seen to be a person who does his or her own thing. That's what's inspiring. And I just think it'd be quite good to have a woman. I think Emma Thompson would be very good at it, because I think what she's very good at is portraying eccentricity. And what's really appealing for Doctor Who, and what is in danger of being lost, is the humour and the eccentricity and the idea that he's just this kind of, you know, slightly crazy old duffer who, because he thinks in such a different way to everyone else, has this ability to do things. And you kind of forget about the fact that he's also got, magic powers or whatever he's got. But, you know...
it's not magic, it's science, Will.
Okay, yeah. Science magic, you know what I mean. So for me, I don't think it matters. I think if you had... And I don't... I've got kids. Mm. And judging by the films they like, they don't really care if it's a man or a woman. And when it was younger, they didn't really care if it was a human or, you know, a bear. Yeah. It didn't matter. The point was is that it was somebody who was doing their own thing and kind of stood up for something on their own terms in a good way.
Yeah.
Not just belligerent way, but, you know, in a good way. So I think that's really what counts.
Surely the BBC should just do a poll on its website just with a photograph from the local GP's office saying, would you prefer to be seen by a female doctor?
Personally, I think a female doctor would be absolutely fantastic, and we've been waiting around for it for ages.
It depends on the relationship. Yeah, it depends on the relationship, doesn't it, as well? Mm. So if you have a female doctor, then, I mean, I presume, and, you know, maybe I'm wrong, you would have a male companion. So how does that work?
You don't have to.
You don't have to. You definitely don't.
You could have
but
a boy
I think
and a girl,
that
as has been in the past. Yeah.
Yeah, you could have twins or something. I mean, you know, I don't know. You could have something like that. And it's interesting, isn't it, when you mess with the accepted dynamic.
Yes.
So generally, with any form of presentation, it's very, very ingrained in our culture that it's older fella, younger woman. And it's when it's messed around, that's really, well, I think
that's
quite
interesting. It is, but on a deep level, you're not really messing with the formula, because the deep level of Doctor Who, can't believe I'm talking about the deep level, but anyway, the significance is this relationship he has with the rest of the world, you know, so I don't think it really matters. I actually disagree with you when you said that you thought that it should be someone young. I prefer it when it's older, because by the time you get older, it's like this person is not going to apologise for anything. They sort of know who they are, and the eccentricity comes out.
You were just saying about the old guy, young girl thing. There's always been a Pygmalion, My Fair Lady aspect. I'm going to show you the universe. I'm teaching you about it. But actually, he ends up learning from the companion.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it is, and those things are very ingrained in our stories. You know, so to mess with them, I think is quite interesting. I would prefer a younger one, actually. Yeah. I have to say, sorry.
Well, let's quickly do the front runners. Firstly, male, Ben Whishaw.
Oh, I love Ben Whishaw.
He's already knocked it back once, hasn't he?
He'd be good.
He would be good. Richard Ayoade.
Yes,
he's perfect, but he won't do
it. I don't think he can do the gravitas of the universe collapsing. I think he's too comedy.
I'm
happy to be proved wrong. Rory Kinnear, great actor, looks a bit like his dad.
He's not quirky enough.
Oh, I don't know about that. All right, females. Olivia Colman appears to be the front runner.
Yeah, she'd be good.
She's good. She's a bit ubiquitous.
Yeah, that's it. I just wonder whether you'd think.
Yeah, but then she'd just settle into Doctor Who for Saturday night for the next
Yeah, but then,
years.
You know, she'd just been watching her doing Broadchurch and everything else. It's quite hard to kind of like.
Forget about all that.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
Gillian Anderson.
No.
Why not?
Serious.
She's
totally stop your Gillian Anderson.
No.
She may be weird, but she doesn't have that glint in her eye.
No, she's too classic.
The comedy's not there.
No, I don't know about that.
No.
Very funny episodes.
No.
I'm sure there are.
You're all wrong. Sure, it's my show. Keely Hawes.
I think she'd be right.
And of course, the one that the papers are flagging all over the place is Miranda Hart.
Oh, please. God, please, no. I would never watch it again.
Yeah, it'd be a Sylvester McCoy.
Exactly.
Riz Ahmed.
Yeah, Riz Ahmed.
I love him.
Well, if it's going to be, I would like to see Phoebe Waller-Fleabag.
Yeah, also she'd be good.
She's posh, Time Lord, and she's weird.
Yeah.
And she could do the comedy as well.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I've heard a lot about her. So
she's quite funny, physically funny as well, so she'd be good.
I'm holding out for Anna Chancellor. Anyway, we could do this all day. time itself is spiralling down to utter destruction and the show is ending. So let's have some closing time chatter where our guests share the stories or ideas that are exciting them or driving them mad this week. Miranda Sawyer, podcast.
Oh, I've got a podcast for you, everyone. Okay. So, you know, I'm aware that we possibly shouldn't say the word Trump on this programme, and I'm sorry for mentioning it at all, but obviously, you know, we are living in strange and appalling times. And one of the things I found very difficult is every time I go to Twitter, every time I read the newspaper, there are more things to deal with that I find scary and difficult to understand. And there is a podcast called Pod Save America, and it's made by four blokes who were very, very involved in the Obama administration. They worked for Obama. They wrote his speeches. So they are absolutely involved in the process of government. And so they are now out, and they did a podcast about their campaigns and now they're out. And they are the podcasts are long. Mm-hmm. They're about an hour long, so they're quite granular, and sometimes you're a bit like, I don't really know what they're talking about. But they explain exactly what it is that is wrong, that is going on, and they do it quite fruitfully. I mean, they're quite unafraid to use the words racist or swear or anything like that. And they unpick it in a way so that I understand it and realise what is actually going on. And it's incredibly interesting, actually. It's really brilliant. I really recommend it.
Pod Save America. Mm. Okay, fantastic. Will Hodgkinson. What have you got for us?
Well, it's a bit of an obvious one, really. It's the Johnny Depp thing. Uh-huh. But I'm just fascinated by it because, first of all, apparently he spends 30,000 $1,000 on wine.
So this is the investigation of his finances.
The investigation of his finances. It's all through the divorce, and then he accused. I think he fired his financial advisors, and then they said, "No, hang on a sec. You're the one who spent $2 million shooting Hunter S. Thompson's ashes into an especially built rocket and all kinds of nonsense." This is okay. This is what was the word used? The clang. So this is a clang. But I did an interview with him a couple of years ago. So I very rarely meet stars of that kind of Hollywood A-list stature. But he was doing this thing called the Hollywood Vampires, where he was doing gigs with Alice Cooper and various other kind of old rockers. And so I did this interview. And first of all, they all said, well, he doesn't drink at all. And secondly, and there's $20,000, well, $30,000 drinking. But anyway, he said he didn't drink at all. And this is the thing. I mean, obviously, I was really starstruck. He was incredibly charming, really nice, everything you'd hope him to be. Did this interview in this grimy little back room, the kind of place I'd do interviews with, rock bands. And the way he came across was someone who really didn't care. He seemed really bohemian. He seemed like he didn't care about money. He said, I didn't really want to be an actor. I just loved playing in bands, but I couldn't make a go of it. And so I became an actor. Everything that he said and the way he was and the way he was just such a kind of one of the guys, really, really nice, stands in direct contrast to all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, so either I'm just a complete mug and I'm willing to think that someone is totally different from the way they are, or he's sort of a victim of circumstance, and suddenly all this money came in.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't really care about it, and he was spending it so willy-nilly that he didn't know that it sort of, he couldn't spend in that way. So it was just very, very confusing. It's one of those rare examples where you have this big news story about this guy whose profligate spending has got him into all kinds of trouble, and you think about to that one, we didn't know the guy, but a very short experience of meeting him for 40 minutes in this kind of grimy back room and him chatting away about rock and roll. And I couldn't put the two together.
But once you're on $30,000 bottles of wine, it's very hard to get down to the $20,000. Get down to the Black Tower and the Blue Nun.
It's really hard. When you interview very famous people, there is an entourage, and God knows what that entourage is doing. whether they're buying small dogs or chateaus. I mean, who knows?
Matt Hall. Speaking of enormous financial profligacy, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I'd missed this, and I don't know if everybody else knows about it, and I'm just really behind the times. That there was a tweet on the 5th of January from the K2 Plant Hire Company.
Yes.
Did you come across this?
I have, yes. I very much come across this. The KLF.
It's there, and it's a poster, fly poster, on a wall, and that's the photo on the tweet. And I'm just going to read it out because it's absolutely brilliant. 2017, what the fuck is going on? It is almost 23 years since the Justified Ancients of Mumu announced a self-imposed and self-important 23-year moratorium.
Moratorium. Moriarty is Sherlock Holmes.
The reasons for the moratorium have now been lost in time, space, and a rusting shipping container somewhere near Sizewell B nuclear power station. What is known is this. The Justified Ancients of Mumu have zero involvement with any video clips, films, recorded music, documentary production, biographies, West End musicals, or social media chatter relating to the letters K, L, or F, now or at any other time over these previous 23 years. Furthermore, the Justified Ancients of Mumu have no interest in anything that seeks to comment on, bounce off, glory, debunk or resurrect their historical work. The Justified Ancients of Mumu are currently at work in their light industrial unit. This work will not be made public until the 23rd of August 2017. For more information, contact K2 Plant Hire Limited.
So basically the KLF are coming back, we think. Yes.
Yeah.
Publicised by a poster stuck up in Dalston, where obviously everybody's going to see it. Yeah, well, I mean, it'd be interesting to see.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I got really excited about it. I put it up on, Facebook and went, oh, it's brilliant, they're back. And then everyone went, oh, it's a hoax. And I went, oh, took it down. And then they went, no, it's not a hoax. So I don't know. But I mean, what we know that they have been doing is Bill Drummond has been involved in his non-recorded music kind of, what do you call it? Mission. Should we call it a mission?
Yes.
So he goes out and he makes people be involved in music, but it is never recorded. And there's something about that I think is absolutely amazing. And Jimmy Courtney has done this mad kind of touring, weird Jake and
riot.
Dinos kind of riot town. So they have been doing stuff. And what's interesting is both of those things are actually about the audience being there and in the moment. You can't take anything away. You have to be there. And so that is interesting in yeah. today's kind of world, I think. So what I'm hoping is that they come out and they do an event and we all go and have a brilliant time and then it's over.
Yes, well, watch that space, I think. I'm going to end the show on a massive, massive downer. My closing time chatter is the new editor of the Today programme on BBC Radio 4, which is Sarah Sands, former editor of the Evening Standard, former editor of the Sunday Telegraph. Now, I spend a lot of my tedious life-wasting time on Facebook saying, hey, come on, the BBC's not biased. BBC doesn't have a conservative bias, an inbuilt Tory right-wing bias. And I look at this and I just think that is a very, very odd appointment to make. But if you're trying to defend yourself as an impartial broadcaster, you know, Sarah Sands ran the Evening Standard, listeners outside London will not know this, but basically as a kind of Notting Hill Boris Johnson fanzine.
But the Evening Standard has always been a really, really weird combination of right-wing journalism and, ooh, the theatre. I mean, it's never been any different for as long as I can remember. The thing I think is interesting is she is not from the BBC. That's important. And, you know, I've done features on the Today programme. I've sat there throughout for 24 hours and kind of falling asleep and everything. And what's very interesting about the Today programmes are the people who are involved and essentially the presenters.
Yeah.
So we can all laugh at John Humphreys if we want to, but I would take him on at, you know, you take him on at your peril. He is really, really, really good. And he is really good at 4 in the morning. Mm. And so that programme is populated by very young, very keen people who are able to stay up for 24 hours and these immense powerhouses of presenters. Honestly, they are rock. And so to come in there and try and shake it up, you have to be able to deal with these immensely strong personalities. You can try and bring stuff in, but, you know, essentially, if you come up against John Humphreys, you're going to have to sack him if he doesn't like you.
I mean,
at a time when impartiality has been more valuable.
But do you think they're bringing her in to show to the government that they can make non-BBC appointments and, look, we've brought this person in who is from the outside to shake things up? Do you not think that's something to do with that?
I think it probably is, but I just think it sends a very strange message. And also, I know from friends at the BBC that they discovered this through the Evening Standard.
Well, that's the interesting. I mean,
they didn't find their BBC.
That's no surprise.
We could probably cut
BBC.
This out, but yeah, but the BBC Radio Press Office has dropped two really large kind of bollocks in the last week.
Yeah.
One of which is Brian Matthews on Sound of the 60s.
Yeah.
Him announcing it because it had not been the way that they were going to announce it hadn't been sorted out. So him going out and saying I'm really upset. And the second is the Evening Standard.
But they are,
and it's just kind of
so
like
neither of them came from the BBC.
Neither of those stories came from the BBC, and you just think something is wrong there. If you've got to worry about, you know, about your message, if you've got a problem with your message getting out into a fairly hostile media environment at the moment, two really big stories on very different ends of the radio spectrum not getting out correctly.
Yeah. Okay, right. Well done, Andrew. Keep it light. So that's our show. Thanks to our guests, Will Hodgkinson, writing in The Times Near You soon, and both Songman and Guitar Man are available in all good bookshops. Thank you, Will. Please come again.
Thank you, I will.
Thank you, too, to Miranda Sawyer, who's Out of Time, is also available in all the very same good bookshops. thank you, Miranda.
It's always a pleasure.
It is always a pleasure. Remember, you can hear this episode again and all of our archive shows at, get your pens out, audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth. And if you've seen Trainspotting 2, why not head over there right now and hear our spoiler-laden podcast extra, where me, Matt, Miranda and Will be giving away all the surprises. You can also subscribe to Big Mouth on iTunes. Just go to the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store, search for Big Mouth, subscribe, and we will send you the podcast version of the show on Saturday, not Sunday, so that you can brag about it in front of all of your friends.
And if you like us, leave a review. That'd be really good.
And if you like us, leave a review. That'll be really good. Matt and I will be back on SohoRadioLondon.com at 9 a.m. next Sunday. In the meantime, Pop Britain, we salute you.